compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, Cyrus, you got you some new taco music, I see.
I'm just getting started.
Good stuff. I do appreciate that. Happy Taco Tuesday, by the way. Here's a note that comes in. In fact, it just came in from Paige. She's listening in Pennsylvania. Patrick, I've always struggled with mornings, but have a deep desire to receive the Eucharist every day. Understandably, not all people are morning people, and I believe our Lord knows this, but almost all daily masses are in the morning. How can I force myself to wake up to go? I struggle with this so much, but later in the day, I feel regret for not getting up. It seems so difficult in the moment to wake up, and it's so easy for me to choose to sleep. Is there a virtue I'm lacking? How did the saints do this so well? Please help. I want to choose our Lord over extra sleep in the morning. Also, how much of this might be physiological or genetic? As to the last part of your question, Paige, I wouldn't know. That's something that if you have, you know, problems, say, with sleep apnea or something that might cause you to be very tired when you wake up, that's something a doctor could help with. I would have no way of knowing. So you can get that checked, though. You can do a sleep study, and maybe they can tell you more. In the meantime, however, I understand the difficulty. Some people, I'm not one of them, but some people, they just have a really difficult time getting up out of bed in the morning because they're so groggy. That could be caused by a number of factors. Maybe you're not getting to bed early enough. Maybe you're not sleeping well through the night. So any of those things are beyond my ability to help with, but doctors and such can help you with that.
What's this person's name?
This is Paige.
Paige, yeah. So mm-hmm. Nighttime Paige has different priorities than morning Paige.
Yeah, when it's midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and you're thinking, well, I'm not really tired right now. Yeah, is that what you mean, Cyrus?
Well,
you will be tired.
Nighttime Paige is like, tomorrow I'm going to wake up, I'm going to mass, I'm going to make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And then morning Paige wakes up and is like, I could really use another 20 minutes of sleep.
Which becomes a half an hour, which becomes an hour. Yeah, that's a good point. Here's my version of that, Cyrus. When I'm not hungry, I plan out, okay, tomorrow I'm going to skip lunch, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm not going to eat any food. And I feel totally good about that when I'm not hungry. But when I'm hungry, that's a different story. I think that's true for most people. So with that in mind, Paige, what I would propose would be this, that number one, you can ask your guardian angel to help you wake up. And you might be surprised at how that really works. I've done that a million and one times. I have to get up for an early flight, or I have to get up in the morning to do a radio show or whatever. And I'll ask my guardian angel, please make sure that I get up. And he does. And some people may say, well, that's just in your own mind. I don't think so. But that's one thing that you can do, is ask your guardian angel for some help. And if you don't have a close relationship with your guardian angel, you can begin by cultivating that sense of asking him to help you with your day-to-day duties, like getting up on time. Obviously, set your alarm. Maybe if you have an iPhone or an Android, you can set 2 or 3 alarms. And just train yourself. This is the last thing. Train yourself that when you hear the alarm, you're conscious of it, you wake up, that you just force yourself to get out of bed. And one way to do it is to put, if your phone is where you get your alarm for the morning, put your phone somewhere away from your bed, away from where you're sleeping, so that you have to physically get up out of bed to turn the thing off. If it's right there on the nightstand next to you, and all you have to do is reach over and, you know, press mute or snooze or whatever, chances are that's what you'll do. So by putting the source of the alarm away from your bed, then you have to get up and turn it off. And then you're up and you stay up. And you just tell yourself, I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to Mass. I'm going to receive Jesus in Holy Communion. So that can be done. And it's a matter, probably more than anything else, of training yourself. So those other things, definitely, what time are you going to bed at night? What kind of sleep are you getting? Where is the alarm? Is it something you can just turn off and roll over and go back to sleep? But the main thing is, in addition to looking into those other things, the main thing is you just tell yourself, I want to get up. Yes, I'm tired, but I'm going to get up and I'm going to move one foot in front of the other and I'm going to get going. And if you train yourself, you will begin to do that. And you sort of alluded to the issue of virtue. The virtue theory of St. Thomas Aquinas, to me, is the best of the best. And the way he approaches this, by looking at, let's say, a vice like sloth. Now, this may not be true sloth on your part, but let's say that it is. So this sort of laziness and lassitude where you don't really apply yourself when you need to, when you should be applying yourself. The way he approaches vices in his treatise on the virtues is to cultivate the opposing virtue. So in the case of lust, for example, you would cultivate the virtues of purity and chastity. And the more you cultivate those, the more they displace the vice. So when it comes to the vice of sloth, you can cultivate the virtue of moderation. And moderation when it comes to sleep is, you know, I got my 8 hours. I don't need any more. It's kind of like I ate my food. I'm full. I don't need any more. Moderation is something that you have to learn. And eventually what happens is it becomes your stable disposition. Right now, I'm guessing your stable disposition is sloth, to fall back to sleep again and not rouse yourself and get up and get going. So little by little, like lifting weights or anything else that involves repetition, after a while you become more and more inclined to do the virtuous thing. That becomes your stable disposition. Kind of like somebody, if you didn't know how to play the piano and you start taking piano lessons and you begin painstakingly practicing the piano and it doesn't sound very good and you're making mistakes all the time. If you do that assiduously for 6 months or longer, could be less for some people, eventually you become a fine piano player. And your disposition now, your stable disposition is the ease of playing the piano because you've applied yourself and you've worked at it and you've practiced and all those things. So it at that point comes easy to you to play the piano, whereas before it didn't come easy to you, you couldn't even do it at all. So maybe approach this topic that way and say that I'm going to cultivate this virtue that's going to get me up out of bed, even though I don't feel like it. And eventually what will happen is, and I don't know how long it will take, a week, 2 weeks, a month, I don't know, maybe a little bit longer for different people, different amount of time. But what will happen is you will eventually switch over to that being your default mode. And you will find that you can do it. So do that and see what happens. And maybe call me in 3 months and let me know how it works out. But I really do believe that's the right answer for your question. Thank you, Paige. How interesting that a simple question like getting out of bed in the morning can affect so many people, but I think it does. How about Christina now in Riverside, California? Good morning, Christina.
Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Good. Okay, good. Okay, so first of all, I heard you say, I forgot.
What's that? You forgot your question?
You said, I just heard, I just heard you say a couple calls ago about something about saving grace, and I just wondered what that meant.
Oh, I think I was referring to faith, and I was referring
saving
to...
Faith. Okay.
Do you want me to address that?
Yeah, whichever it was you said, I'm just curious, yeah.
I believe it was that, as I recall. So I was referring to the supernatural virtue. So the three cardinal virtues, faith, hope, and charity. And everything hinges, that's why they're called cardinal virtues, from the Latin word for hinge. But the spiritual life hinges upon those three virtues, the supernatural virtues of faith, hope, and charity. And so when it says in the Bible, the need to do good works, etc., it presupposes that you have faith as the starting point. So for example, in Ephesians 2, beginning in verse 8, it says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith. This is a gift of God. This is not of works, lest anyone should boast." Then it goes on to talk about the role of good works. But to use that passage as a foundation here, everything in your relationship with the Lord is a gift of His grace. You cooperate with it, but even that is a grace. So when it says that by grace you have been saved through faith, faith is your assent to what God says is true. I'll quote to you from Hebrews 11, beginning in verse, we can begin in verse 1. So faith, it says, is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it, let me just mute the background noise here. So for by it, people of old received their commendation. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through faith, though he died, he still speaks. And then it goes on to give a variety of other examples here about faith. But that first part is the most important part here. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So saving faith, as I referred to it in the Ephesians 2 sense, is that the grace that God gives you enables you to believe, to say, I believe in you, God. I believe in you, and I believe in what you say, what you tell me to be true. That's the starting point. And without that, nothing else could save anybody. You couldn't be saved if you didn't have that faith. Now, I don't want to over-explain it, but in context, that's what I was referring to. Does that help, Christina?
Here's the thing, though. If using that as the context of my question is, if my granddaughter, who is a Christian, is falling in love with a boy who is a Catholic, how is this all going to work out? Saving grace, saving faith, whatever. I mean, how they could never agree, right?
Well, maybe, but maybe not. Keep in mind that the Catholic Church is the original Christianity. It's the church Christ established. And so I understand what you mean, Christian and Catholic. I think maybe more specifically it's Protestant and Catholic or Evangelical and Catholic. But the Catholic Church, by definition, is the original Christianity that goes back to the time of Jesus. But to your point, if they don't have the same understanding and belief in who Jesus is and what he wants of us, then that sets up a inevitable kind of friction if they can't share their faith in common. So I would not encourage Catholics and Protestants to get married. I mean, sometimes there are success stories, that's true, but by and large, typically, it doesn't end in a happy way. Either one of a few things happens, Christina. Either the Catholic Party winds up becoming Protestant, and then they're united in that regard, or the Protestant Party becomes Catholic, which may be less often, and then they're united, and that's good. Or if they stay together, there is a lifelong division when it comes to going to church on Sunday, for example, and how are we going to raise the kids? Are the kids going to be raised Catholic or Protestant? And the Catholic Party has an obligation to raise the kids as Catholic. And then another and even more common option is, Even though some couples stay together, but they have that difficulty at the heart of their marriage, more often than not, they break up. And so divorce enters the picture. So this is not intended to be disrespectful to anybody one way or the other, but long and painful history has shown that if you have a Catholic and a Protestant who fall in love, it's true, it could possibly work out, but normally it doesn't. So I wouldn't encourage that if I had some say in the matter.
And I met this couple, and they, one was Catholic and one was Protestant, and they each went to their own churches, and then the other one would join them sometimes. You know, they would sometimes go together to each church, and I don't know. I don't know.
It's not a recipe promising. It's not a recipe for unity and long-term tranquility in the marriage. I mean, marriage, let's face it, there are plenty of things in marriage anyway that are difficult. In any marriage, even the best of marriages, there are difficulties. But to add, to front-end load another big difficulty right at the outset is not a good idea. Well, I hope that's helpful to you, Christine. I do appreciate that. Thank you. And quickly, let's get to Elena in Orlando. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning. Okay. Yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking
You're
my
welcome.
Call.
Yes.
I'm calling regarding the previous caller that is just having a hard time waking up in the morning because I had the same problem before. So the way I resolved it is I'm always late on my daytime job. I work in accounting and I'm always late.
Okay.
So what I did is I took a nighttime job from 11 to 7 a.m., so from there, I just go straight to my accounting job.
Well, you've got pluck.
And then
that's
after
for sure.
that, I gave up my daytime job. So I work 11 to 7 a.m. and then I go straight to church for 8:30 mass.
That's very good. That's very good. I think the lady I talked to a little while ago, she was having a problem actually physically getting out of bed because she was so tired in the morning. So... if you have the ability to rouse yourself and get up and get going, that's a good thing.
But that's the same thing, my problem. I cannot get up early in the morning, so I took a nighttime job. So I'm already awake. So all I have to do is go straight to my daytime.
Right. I hear what you're saying. In other words, you're already up, so you don't have to worry about that. But
correct.
Here's the thing, though. If somebody said to you, listen, Elena, if you'll get out of bed, I'll give you, you know, if you get up and get going and go out into the living room, there's $100 there for you. And if you don't get up and don't go out there, the $100 goes away. Chances are you get up and go out there and get the $100. I think most people would. So we will do what we're motivated to do, even if it's difficult. And that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. There was a time when, for me, getting out of bed in the morning was really difficult. And it just got to the point where I said, no, I'm not going to be ruled by that. If I need to get up, I need to get up. I'm going to get up. And if I feel groggy, okay, I feel groggy. But it's an act of the will. And I know for some people it's more of a struggle than for others, but I don't think it's beyond anyone's reach. We just have to say, I'm going to do it.
It's a habit. But the hardest part is the beginning, the start, to have yourself get started.
Yes, I agree. But as I was saying earlier, and you and I are on the same wavelength here, once you get started and once you push yourself and you keep doing it, it gets easier and easier and easier. And before you know it, you bound out of bed, ready for the day, and it's not a struggle anymore.
Exactly. I agree 100%. Okay.
Well, you sound like a hardworking lady, Elena, so thank you for your information. Appreciate that. All right. Well, you know what that music means. It means we're going to take a break, but we're going to come right back with more of your phone calls and your emails. The number to call to be on the air is 888-914-9149. That number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. So come on, I get up. I won't say it again. I'll drag you out. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com. Wake me up.
Are we really? We're really doing this, aren't we?
You're the one dancing to it.
Oh, man. Man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. You know, I'm Only Sleeping by the Beatles would have been a better choice.
Now you tell me. All right. Full disclosure, this was
playing this from your personal music.
This was not my idea. This is someone. There's only two of us in the room, and it wasn't
my
idea.
Put me out of my misery, please. Kill it.
Kill it.
Kill the song.
Kill it quick.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, that was something. 888-914-9149. By the way, I want to acknowledge the half a dozen of you in the last couple of minutes who have sent kind and thoughtful emails to me with all sorts of recipes for magnesium and other things for your body so that you will sleep well. Thanks for taking the time to write. This is a note from Jay Portales, Javier Portales, that is, in Texas. He says, I recall hearing on your program that holy water should not be consumed. Did I understand correctly? Could you elaborate why this is not allowed? Okay. No, you didn't understand correctly. You can drink holy water if you want to. I don't recommend it. I mean, if you are talking about like holy water out of the holy water font at church, definitely I don't recommend that, because who knows how many people's germy fingers have been dipped in that water. So no, but I mean, if let's say you have some fresh water and the parish priest prayed the prayers of exorcism and that's the longer version of it and makes it holy water, no reason why you can't drink that. I mean, there's certainly no prohibition on drinking holy water. I don't recommend it if it's common holy water that other people have dipped into, but I'm not sure what you might have heard me say that would give you that misimpression, but I'm glad I can clear that up for you. So if you want to, great. But it doesn't really do anything for you. Holy water, let's remember, it's a sign, it's a symbol of baptism. And baptism is a sign that really accomplishes what it symbolizes, but it's a sign of Christ's victory over death. And the reason I'm going into this little detail here is because holy water is it's an external thing, like washing your body. St. Peter says that baptism now saves you. It's not the washing of dirt from the body, but an appeal to God for a clean conscience. So the act of baptism as a sacrament is, it cleanses your soul, and it's symbolic of that by being baptized, by bathing, by water, cleaning the dirt off your body. So that's an analogy for what baptism really does for the soul. The reason I mention that is because drinking holy water is sort of departing from the symbol. It's not it's not consistent. I mean, it's not that you can't do it, but it begins to move away from the symbolic meaning of holy water, symbolizing baptism. All right, let's see. Let's go to Patricia in Spanish Fort, Alabama. Hi, Patricia. Welcome.
Hello, Patrick. I have a question about stillborn babies. My friend, her baby was born yesterday, and she was stillborn, and she was like 4 weeks before delivery. Mm-hmm. And when a stillborn baby is born, do you call a priest? Do you have a funeral? I mean, I don't really know anything about that, because it just happened yesterday, and I'm so concerned about this girl. She's has four children. This would have been her fifth, and this is not the first time it's happened. This is the second baby that was born stillborn to her.
So, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's really sad. It breaks my heart.
So a couple questions, Patricia. One is, did she know for some time ahead of time, like maybe even weeks? Sometimes that happens where the mother will find out from the doctor that the child has already died in utero. Did she know that, or was she taken by surprise?
She was taken by surprise. It just happened yesterday morning. She knew that there was something wrong. She had called her mother and told her there's something wrong. We're going to the doctor. And the girl, I was in Mass, and she's a friend of mine. She came up to me and she said, my daughter Jennifer is going to go to the hospital. She's going to go to the doctor. She thinks something's wrong with the baby. So would you pray? And I did, and I prayed and prayed. And then she texted me and told me that she was about to deliver. The baby's name would have been Agnes Bernadette, and that she was going to deliver the baby in probably in about an hour, and that the baby was already in heaven with Jesus.
Okay. I'm so sorry to hear that this happened. The reason I asked that question was because sometimes the baby has been dead for some time. It can be days, weeks, even. In other cases, the child could die very soon, very close to the time of birth, maybe an umbilical cord problem, the kind of thing. Now, the reason I'm asking that question is because if there's any doubt about whether or not that that stillborn baby might still be alive, even though it appears to be dead, or he or she appears to be dead, in a case like that where there's some question, then baptism would be appropriate. So you're asking like, well, what can you do or what should you do? So the first thing would be if it's possible that this baby has just died or is maybe not dead yet, if it's possible that the baby is not dead yet, then baptize. That'd be the first thing you should do. Now, if it's clear because the doctor said there's no heartbeat, we will deliver the stillborn child in 6 days or 5 days or 8 days, whatever, then there's no need to baptize because the soul and the body have already separated. That's why I asked that question. Now, as far as funerals are concerned, certainly. In fact, you don't have to have a funeral. Now, this depends upon what, you know, when in gestation this took place. So if the baby came to term, yes, definitely, I would have a funeral. And if the child dies earlier in gestation, say through miscarriage, the parents can also have a funeral if they wish. It depends on how early. Sometimes it's not possible to even retrieve a body, but not in this case that you're describing. So yes, as to that question, I would contact the parish priest and say we'd like to arrange for a funeral for this child, graveside service and so on. Now, as far as the eternal destiny of the child is concerned, this is what the church says, that we should be hopeful in the Lord's love for that child. He loves the child even more than we do. And so we should be hopeful and trust that the Lord in his mercy would give sanctifying grace to an unborn or a stillborn child so that he or she can go to heaven for all eternity. Now, we don't know exactly how God does that, but the church says that we should hope for that and pray for that. The church doesn't say the child is definitely in heaven. I know that's a comforting thought for parents. I understand that. Our number 12, Nancy and I have 11 children, and our 12th child died in miscarriage. So for me, I have a real son or daughter who I want to see in the afterlife, and the church doesn't say that child's definitely in heaven, even though it's comforting for the parents to think that. But rather, the church says, let's hope and trust in God's mercy that he will do this. And then we leave it at that. So those are some thoughts on your question, Patricia. I hope that's helpful to you. And my sincere condolences to the whole family. I'm sure the mother especially is suffering greatly as a result of this blow. Thank you. Let's go to Carl in Richmond, California now. Good morning, Carl. Or I'm sorry, Richmond, Virginia.
Good morning. My question has to do with receiving communion. If you believe in the true presence, the individual receiving the communion and believes in the true presence is also attends a Protestant church, Korean Protestant church service, and receives when they do have communion. And I had a conversation with her recently, and I want to know if what I'm saying to her was correct or not. I said to her that you're saying you believe in the true presence, that even if you go to the Protestant service, she tells me I'm receiving communion, I believe it's the true presence, but I said that wafer or the form that you're receiving is not the true presence because it hasn't been consecrated. So even if you're saying you believe in the true presence, receiving their form of communion is not the true presence. And I don't know, I'm wondering if that was correct in saying
that. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. So is the lady in question Catholic or is she Protestant?
She did go through the RCIA and she's now is Catholic.
So she was received into the church and she received her sacraments?
Correct.
Okay, so she should not be receiving any kind of communion service in any Protestant church because, number one, she's Catholic and so she has the real thing. She really has Jesus present in the Holy Eucharist when she goes to Mass. So it's not right or proper for her to go anywhere else where it's not truly the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus, as it certainly is not at the Korean Protestant Church. Now, this is not to gainsay their sincerity. People are very sincere and they love God and they're seeking to please him, but they can still be wrong. And in your sincerity doesn't, I don't mean yours, but her sincerity doesn't make up for the fact that it's not objectively really Jesus present in Holy Communion. So that's one reason why she should not receive that. But the more important reason is because she's now a Catholic. She should be receiving Holy Communion, the Holy Eucharist, at Mass and only there. So maybe her catechism, maybe she wasn't catechized as thoroughly as she should have been, and that's where you can help. How are you related to her? Is she a friend, a coworker, a relative?
This is a very close cousin, my cousin's wife.
Okay.
And I just was with them in Duluth, Georgia, and we had this conversation. I was compelled to call you to ask that question. I know you've talked about the key thing was when she said she believes in the true presence and that she is a Catholic. I asked, are you a professed Catholic now? And she said she did. Now, I didn't, when you asked about the other sacraments, I have to say, I guess I'm not 100% sure if she's got the confirmation piece of it. I'm not 100% sure, but she said she's a Catholic now. She got that sacrament, but she got the first communion Eucharist.
Yeah. I would suggest, if you're so inclined, get her a book called The Hidden Manna. And it is a really good one-volume theology of the Eucharist, taking into account Scripture and the Church Fathers and all of the above. So I would suggest, if you want to help her really learn the specifics about the Holy Eucharist, that would be a good one. Well, thanks, Carl. It's good of you to be on the lookout for her like that, and I'm sure she appreciates it, or hopefully in due time will appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Once again, thank you. You keep sending me emails about how to conquer getting up sleepy in the morning. I appreciate it, but I want to save you the time, because they're not emails that I can read on the air. So for the about 10 of you now who have written into me to tell me your secret for getting up in the morning when you feel sleepy, thank you for doing that. This is from John, and he's saying, to the caller who asked about her friend who believes in God but doesn't worship him, will that person be saved? My response is, the devil believes in Jesus, but he'll never get into heaven. That's true. St. James says as much in James chapter 2. He says, even the demons believe, you know, even they have faith in God in the sense that they believe that he exists. So John says, I love the show. You got me back to confession after about 20 years. Wow. And my faith, I want to learn more about my Catholic faith. My faith is growing stronger each day. Thank you. Well, gosh, John, thank you so much. It's great to hear from you. Thank you for saying that. And isn't God generous with his grace and how he works through Relevant Radio in just amazing ways? So 20 years away from the faith, and now you're back stronger than ever. That reminds me of the Chicago song. Cyrus, I know how much you like Chicago. Feeling stronger every day. That's a great song by Chicago. Do you know that song, John? You should check it out. Feeling Stronger Every Day by Chicago. Let's see. Thank you for that email. And also, this is a note from Francisco, listening in New Jersey. He says, Patrick, I recall that you spoke about a battle that took place between Christians and Muslims. The Muslims say they won when they actually lost. A refresher would be great. Well, it depends on, there's been innumerable battles between Christians and Muslims, and I don't know which one you're referring to, and I don't recall which one I may have mentioned. It could be that you're asking a question that had to do with the Crusades. And that was sort of a seesaw back and forth between the Catholic folk who came from Europe primarily to help rescue the other Catholics who were overrun by the Muslims when they invaded and colonized what once was Catholic land. Sometimes the Catholic armies won, sometimes they lost. And then in the end, they wound up losing big time, and those lands were under the more or less permanent control of the Muslims at that point. But I don't know that that's necessarily what you're asking about. What I can tell you about when we come back, I'll look it up during the break. We're going to take a break here in a moment. There is a scholar of history who put together a very interesting and impressive graphic video showing the various battles that were fought by Muslims against Christians, and how over time, from the 6th century onward, how that expanded across the Mediterranean world. And that could be what you're thinking about. I'll find that, and I'll tell you the name of the guy who did it. Maybe that's what you want to look up on YouTube. Hey, there's that song, Feeling Stronger Every Day by Chicago. I'll be right back. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Now that's what I'm talking about, Cyrus.
And it's no George Michael.
Well, yeah.
That's the whole point.
Remember that other guy in Wham? Nobody knows his name.
I don't know.
I didn't even know what he did. Can you imagine going through life saying, yeah, I was the other guy in Wham? Oh, yeah, that's right. There was another guy in Wham.
Oh, there's another guy?
Oh, you're that guy. One reason why this is good music to play is because the emails keep, I don't know why, but they keep coming in. More and more people are sending me emails about their diet and exercise routine for people who have difficulty getting up in the morning, have magnesium in your diet, etc. It's thoughtful and I appreciate it, but I think we moved past that point, so you don't need to keep... I mean, who am I to say don't send me an email, but I won't be able to read it on the air. But thank you. 888-914-9149. Elena wrote in to say, Patrick, can you help me understand what Jesus meant when he said to one of the disciples who wanted to follow him, let the dead bury their dead. Okay, so this is a very interesting and enigmatic statement from Jesus. And that has to do with a man who wants to follow Jesus. Jesus calls him and he gives an excuse why he can't go. Because, you know, I've got to go do this first. I got to go do that first. This is in Matthew chapter 8. You'll also see it in Luke chapter 9. And Jesus says, okay, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. And you may say, what on earth does this mean? It's a way of saying that unlike this man, this disciple who wanted to follow Jesus and said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father, he was attending to his rightful duty as a son. He was attending to his rightful duty in daily life. You have to go to the DMV from time to time, get your license updated. You've got to go grocery shopping. You've got to do all these things that we all have to do. The Lord is using hyperbole here, which is exaggeration to make a point. But the deeper meaning is, I'm inviting you to enter into eternal life, not right away, of course, but to enter into the life of grace. And the dead here are referring to those who are still dead in their sins. They don't have faith. They're going about their day-to-day duties, but they're not alive in the spirit the way you will be. You'll be baptized, you'll be my follower, etc. So the Lord here is saying that when you're called to follow him, as we all are, but when you recognize that call, you realize that God is calling you and he wants you to be born into eternal life. And in the meantime, in this life, to receive the life of grace in your soul, that's the way he's using the term dead. Let them take care of those things. So he's not saying don't show respect to your father or don't go about your daily mundane duties. I would say it's a deeper meaning that he's proposing. And the secondary part of it is that when you, just like with the apostles, Peter, James, and John, when Jesus called them and he said, you know, you're fishermen right now, but I'll teach you how to become fishers of men. When he invited them to come with him, we're told that they left everything and followed him. And by everything, it means everything. Peter was married. Perhaps James and John were married too. We're not told. They had a fishing business. They had probably employees or at least coworkers, and they left everything. They left their homes, they left their jobs, they left the way of life as they knew it, and they followed Jesus. That too is part of this statement when he says, you know, come, he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. That's another, maybe an echo of his words to Peter, James, and John, and that is, you know, you leave everything and you get up and go. So how does that fit, let's say, in the case of a religious vocation for a woman or a man, or the vocation of the priesthood for a man? You give up everything to follow Jesus. You give up the joy and happiness of marriage and family. You give up a career. You give up, you know, things as you knew them, and you go away to study at a seminary, and you follow Jesus. And who knows where that priestly vocation may lead you to minister? Who knows where that religious vocation may lead you to pray and to work? So that, too, is part of it. And I appreciate the email. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Keith now in Wausau, Wisconsin? Good morning, Keith.
Good morning. I'm actually that other guy in Wham.
I'm sorry, but, what's your name? Because nobody seems to know. Oh, it's Keith. Okay.
Yes, Keith.
Yeah. Anyway, now we know who the other guy in Wham is. Okay.
Yeah, a member of the Six Decade Club. Love to lose it. But real quick, the question is, what do we consider souls in purgatory? Are they members of the church triumphant or the church,
Suffering? Church suffering. So there are three categories: a church militant, that's us here on earth; the church suffering, the souls in purgatory who are destined for heaven, but they're not there yet; and the church triumphant, which is the souls in heaven with God.
Okay, real quick, I've always thought of the souls in purgatory, they're like the second string; they're on the bench, right? They need us, and if we go too much, then you know they can help us too. So it's kind of a two-way street.
That is one way to look at it. I look at it as those guys have it made, man, because they're going to heaven no matter what. For us, it's still a little bit iffy, but they've passed through death and they're guaranteed they're going to heaven. They just need that extra purification. So although I don't envy them being in purgatory, there is a, you know, they've passed their test. They've run the race. They've fought the good fight. They've died in the state of grace. So they know they're going to be in due time. They'll be with God in heaven. For us, we're still fighting that battle. So that's another way to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess from a selfish point of view, which it really is, that's why we pray for them, right? Because they can't help us while they're in suffering, church suffering. But as soon as they get to the church triumphant, they can intercede on our behalf. So indeed, it's like we're increasing our team. And that's my point.
I get you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome. And so what was it like being in Wham? You probably didn't have much to do because George Michael hogged all the limelight, didn't he?
Not all that. Even my wife, man, she was torn up when he died. And everyone knew that my wife liked, I can't even think of the guy's name.
Well, the other guy or George Michael? Because they're two different.
George Michael, my nemesis. Yeah, the guy that got all my attention.
Well, if it weren't for him, you wouldn't have made all that money in all those music videos that you were in back in the 80s.
That's true.
You got a good sense of humor, Keith. I like you. Thank you. And we're going to... we're going to play some more Wham, are we? Okay.
I like the way you shake your head to the music.
Yeah, I'm tapping my toe. Freedom is actually a pretty good song. And Everything She Wants was actually, when that song first came out, that was everywhere on the radio.
You know a lot more about Wham than I do.
I probably just exhausted my knowledge of Wham music. Everything She Wants, that was a good song. I mean, it was a good beat. I did like the song Freedom. I liked it.
I'm going to see my way out of this conversation.
Yeah.
You are on your own.
This is a Wham free zone, may I say. So no mas Wham. Let's go to Joe in Wellington, New Jersey. Good morning, Joe.
Yes, good morning. I called you a couple weeks ago and I told you that I had met a party. We became friends. He's a Calvinist.
Okay.
And I told him about if I go to his church, I can't receive communion. And if you come to
Catholic, I remember that.
You can't receive communion. And we're still friends. I just want to refresh your memory. Okay. So now he calls me up the other day out of the blue. You know, he's been calling me his guardian angel for the last 3 weeks. That gave me the chill. Anyway, he developed a 9mm, what he called a stone, in the roof of his mouth. He said he was in excruciating pain. He popping all kinds of painkillers and stuff, nothing helped. He finally went to an urgent care center. They looked at it, did a CAT scan, and said, oh yeah, we got to operate, we got to take it out. We don't know exactly what it is. So I said, well, look, let's pray for it first and see what happens. So I wasn't sure which saint to pray for. I just looked online real quick. I think it was a French saint, Saint R-O-C-H, Roch. I don't know if they would say that. And I recited the prayer.
So here's my question, Joe, if you don't mind, just because we're getting close to the break. Are you leading up to a question? Because the medical diagnosis will take too long.
No. It fell out on its own. An hour and a half later, he was completely out of pain. So he's calling it a miracle.
Okay,
so my question was, I'm not too quick to call things miracles. How do we know it wouldn't have happened if I didn't pray for him? That's a question always pops into my head when you pray for somebody.
I suppose there is, forgive my interruption, I suppose there is no way to know for sure, because now that it has happened, you can only speculate what could or might have happened.
Right.
But who knows? Who knows? I mean, it's good that you prayed for him. That's good.
Yeah, and he said, "So you want me to become a Catholic?" I said, "That's up to God, not up to me."
Well, tell him Patrick Madrid says, "Yeah, become a Catholic. That's where he belongs."
Oh yeah. Okay, so that was That's what I thought the answer was. Well, can't know for sure. So I guess that's where faith takes over.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, it's good that you're his friend. And it's good that you're praying for him and all of the above. So who knows, maybe as you develop this friendship with him, he might be willing to start listening to Relevant Radio, and then we can help you help him. So thanks, Joe. Appreciate the call. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Gwen now in New Jersey. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Patrick. I enjoy your show. I listen when I can.
Thank you.
Right. My question is, in the church, on Good Friday, we went to church, and there was an elderly gentleman outside walking around the church. We were trying to open up the doors. The doors were locked. Can they do Mass anytime they want? I always thought it was at 3 o'clock when Christ died.
Well, we don't have Mass on Good Friday in any case.
No, no. Okay. That's right. I know, but the Passion.
So what you mean is like the veneration of the cross and the seven last words and all that?
Yes.
It depends upon the parish, of course, but I think the tradition or the custom is many parishes, maybe most of them, do it starting at noon, and then it will go. I mean, our parish started at noon, and it went till 5:30.
Yes.
So, I mean, it can be as long as that. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Because we went there at 3, and there was no sign on the door saying the time. It's usually at 3 o'clock.
That I don't know what to tell you. I mean, sometimes things happen. The priest gets stuck in traffic, or he falls ill, or who knows? I don't know. But if it was publicized that it would begin at, say, 3 o'clock or noon or what have you, then probably something came up.
Something that had to come up. That's my guess. We were wondering that, and when lady said, "Well, didn't Jesus die at 3? She says, "Maybe they changed it to a different time, but there should have been a notification on the door, and there was nothing."
These things happen, so maybe somebody got hurt, or who knows? I mean, if you called the parish office, perhaps the secretary would tell you what happened, but it's, water under the bridge, I would think.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
But I went back anyway on Sunday for Mass.
Good for you. That's the right thing to do.
I thank you for your show. And you have the nicest, humble voice in the world.
Oh, boy. Thank you, Cyrus. Or thank you, Gwen. Did you hear that, Cyrus?
Yes, I did.
I want Cyrus to hear this. Any other nice things you want to say, Gwen? This is your chance. Just kidding.
Then, thank you. Keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Nice chatting with you. Thank you. Isn't Gwen nice?
That was very nice.
People are so kind. Here's a note that came in. This is from Michelle. I've attended a wonderful Catholic church on occasion over the last 10 years. It's well attended, vibrant priests. They do not kneel during the consecration, though. Is this okay? I feel uncomfortable not kneeling, and when I have, I can hear sighs from people around me. I have tried to research this and found the celebrant can ask the people in the pews to remain standing if the church is full and people are standing. This way the congregation would be unified. This is not always the case, and it's a regular practice at this church to remain standing. Okay, well, the approved posture by the U.S. bishops in this country for that time of the Mass is kneeling. Now, it is true that bishops do have the competence to make other arrangements if they see fit to do so in some unusual circumstance. But this doesn't sound like it's any unusual circumstance. It sounds to me as though kneeling during the consecration is deemed to be by this priest or priest, what have you, as too traditional. And unfortunately, there is a mindset in some quarters where people, priests don't want people to kneel during the consecration because that's just too stuffy. That's too pre-Vatican II. That's too traditional. You have the right to kneel. The church says the posture that is appropriate for Catholics in the United States is to kneel. And if only those priests who, for some strange reason, insist on doing otherwise, if only they would get with the program. But that's what you're dealing with there. Thank you. I'll be right back.